So I was really glad when Kent asked me to deliver this speech because I actually grew up in a small village about 45 minutes from here. And I love the West, and I love the people and the connection to the land. And this is actually true. Sometimes when I'm stuck underground in the subway in New York, I have this fantasy that I'll just sort of Bugs Bunny my way back to Albuquerque. Like, just end up there, and I'll suddenly be back, and I'll breathe. And that hasn't happened, but a girl can dream. And I was also excited because when he contacted me, what he was interested in was a speech that I tried to deliver at a New York publishing event last year. And some of you may have read it online. It's about race. It's about publishing. And the first time I tried to give it, it was an utter disaster. The room was loud. People tuned it out. You know, when you give a speech, you put a lot into it. So I had spent two, 3 weeks perfecting it, reading it and perfecting it. And then as the kind of audience fell away, and because it was a topic that was so personal to me, and I just did that weird thing, which is I just kept reading because it mattered so much to me. But at the end, it was this ring of sort of sad faces. It was a little bit brutal. I actually walked all the way down 6th Avenue crying, pausing twice to go to a bar, get a shot of whiskey, take it, keep going, crying. Like a beautiful moment in my life. But then here comes Kent, and he says, hey, if you would like to give that speech again, I have a room full of people that would really appreciate hearing it. So here's the thing. You guys know this. Seeing something written and hearing out loud is a very different experience. I've never gotten to give this speech. So I'm going to do something today, which is I'm going to give you the speech that I intended to give that day because you are a captive audience and the sound system is good in here. And then after I give it, I'm going to talk a little bit about what's happened since, and then after that, we're going to solve the problems of the universe. It's a lie. But we're going to start. Okay, so here we go. True story. A few months ago, a producer from a literary show on Boston Public Radio asked me to read a section of my book on air. I sent it to him, and he said he would need to edit it down. I totally got it. Radio is a different medium. Stories need to change. Sure, edit it down. Then I got the edits back, and some of them were the normal thing where they take 300 words and they cut it to 25. And then there were others. My characters' names, he wrote, were confusing. There were three in the scene. This is of a book that's been published in many countries at this point. But could I cut them to two? If I was going to stick with the unfamiliar names. This was a really funny suggestion, by the way, because I thought, like, well, so if I change them to Mary and Tom and Jane, do I get to keep all three? Or no, anyway. And then there was this even weirder note, which is that in the sentence setting the scene up, I had written three East Indian teenagers, kids of immigrants, sit talking on the roof of a house. And in his notes, he had crossed out East Indian and written Asian Indian. Asian Indian, as if that is a thing that anyone has ever said to anyone else. Except in the following sentence. No, not like American Indian, like Asian Indian. Okay, so then the note goes on. It says, alas. He really did say that, alas. Alas, Americans aren't familiar with the term East Indian. It's just not something we say over here. So this is when my soul made an actual Chewbacca. You know, you guys know the Chewbacca, like, totally had that noise. And so I took a deep breath, which is actually, no, I took a shot of whiskey. That's a real common theme. We're just going to go with that one today. Alas, I wrote back. Alas, Boston Public Radio producer of literary shows, I am from America. I was born here and have lived here many decades among other Americans, other East Indian Americans even, which is what we are called. But if that makes you uncomfortable in some way, we can use the broader term South Asian. We used South Asian. I was not okay about this for days, just days. And I could not figure out why, because honestly, with some of the stuff I've come up against in my life, this was kind of a nothing. It wasn't anything I hadn't seen on tour. There was a time that I was at a book festival party in Florida where a donor who had actually gotten me down there turned to me in the middle of dinner and said, "You know, your English is so good, I can barely hear your accent." It's like, which accent are you hearing? Anyway, one of my favorites actually was after a Q&A in Massachusetts. This guy in his 60s turns and asks, "My son is dating an Indian woman?" Like, that was the question. I felt like saying, okay, and? But this thing with the Boston radio producer really got under my skin in a way that neither of those did, and I could not figure out why exactly until I talked to my best friend, Allison. And she said, "I think it's the way that he cloaked his casual racism in his profession. Like, it was just professional for him to point out how confusing you are to his audience." Right? So here's the thing about how discrimination works. No one ever comes right out and says, "We don't want you." In the publishing world, they don't say, "We don't want your story." They say, "We're not sure you're relatable, and you don't want to exclude anybody with your work." And they say, "We're not sure who your audience is." I believe that. I believe that there still are some people in this industry who are not sure who my audience is. But I do not for a minute believe that is because my audience doesn't exist. To be clear, I'm well aware that I have gotten a great shake of things, an excellent year in which a book that I wrote was shepherded through an enthusiastic and thoughtful house. And the selling and the editing, all of these things went really well. And to pretend they didn't would be misleading. But out in the world, in the marketing in the book, I was surprised by how repeatedly I was asked to whitewash my story, to make my book seem more relatable to audiences, as if none of those audiences had people like me in them. So I guess that's the thing that I'm trying to speak here to, this shadowy, persistent, pervasive idea that somehow stories like the one I wrote are hard for the average American to connect to, the assumption that the average American looks nothing like me. So here's the thing. My book, that book that we were just talking about, it isn't actually about characters having unusual names or not knowing how to ethnically identify themselves. Shocker. It's about what happens to a family when one of their members starts to disappear right in front of them. And it's about how love can really mess you up and save you in the same moment. And so I'm going to tell you something else that happened when the book came out. Because the first time it happened, I was actually right here in New Mexico with my hometown crowd. And there was this one woman in the front row, and I remember her. I remember her because she was wearing a green T-shirt. And because she was alone, and because I frankly knew the other people in the front row. And she was white, and she was in her 60s, and she actually looked scared a lot of the time that I was reading, and I couldn't figure out what that was about, but I was aware of it. And then afterward, during the signing, she came up to me and kind of said in this very soft way, "My husband died 2 months ago, and my kids gave me your book. And this is the first time I've come out of the house. And I just wanted to say thank you for writing it." I'm totally going to cry when I say that. It was so, you know that moment when your heart just kind of cracks. And I didn't actually know what to do in that moment, so I'll tell you that I got up and hugged her, because that's, I think, what you do. But I felt this thing that happened over and over again, and that was the first time, but really it happened with a lot of people of all ages and all races and all genders, and it happened at readings, and it happened in emails, and a lot of times it was just a thank you for writing this book, but just as often it was someone calling me out on the family dynamics and saying, I know you wrote about the Indians, but really this is my family, this is us, this is the Jews, this is the Italians, this is the Greeks, this is the Dominicans, this is the Koreans, this is us. And I have to tell you, just having that happen, having everyone so convinced it was their story, did something for me. in this incredible way. Because my whole life I've been told that no one is sure of who my audience is, right? But I felt it in that moment. I kept wanting to turn around to some invisible recorder that was recording everything and be like, see? Anyway, so I'm not telling you guys this because I'm some kind of Pollyanna. I'm not looking to kumbaya the situation of writers of color away. But the thing is, the publishing industry and where we are right now is my great hope. Because we are in a place where we are starting to push the boundaries of what the industry takes on. And so you are the ones that need to know what I found out again and again and again with every piece that I publish, which is that American audiences are capable of so much more than your industry imagines. And if we can break that down into what I really mean is this. White Americans can care about so much more than just themselves. They really can. And the rest of us, we are dying to see ourselves anywhere. I'm not asking for altruism here. I actually worked in corporate America for 20 years before I put my book out. So I know the stakes. I know the economics. But what I'm saying makes actual, solid business sense. There is a vast, untapped audience out here. And you need to get to us. We are living in a time when what it means to be other is shifting dramatically. When my white best friend can and will help me unpack a racially fraught situation. When I put out a piece, I'm working on a graphic memoir, this little thing about my son's obsession with Michael Jackson and how it relates to everything from what happened in Ferguson to what happens in my marriage, that little piece went viral within an hour. And I looked at who was sharing that. I looked at the metrics. And guess what? It wasn't just the Asian Indians. It was everyone. Because all of us are so ready to talk about this world that we live in. We are ready to have a publishing industry that is of that world. And I know that some of you are here thinking, oh my God, I am doing everything I can about this every day. And I get that. And I actually know that because I see you, I hear you, and I know about these things that are happening. But I also know that for every person that's doing that, there are some of you who haven't done that yet, who maybe understand that there is a huge gap between the many American experiences and the books that speak to them, and who cautiously scan the dialogue on their Twitter feed, but have no idea how to engage with it, or if engaging with it is your job. So I'm telling you, it is your job. Get in here. Be part of this. You ignore us to your own peril, to the industry's peril. And let's face it, we are all here because we love books, right? What we love, what books do in the world and how they breed introspection and compassion. And my guess is if that you've taken the heart of this work on, it probably wasn't for the money. It was because doing the hard work of making sure humans understand each other is important to you. It matters. It changes things. So to all of you here, I say thank you for the job you do. It is not an easy job, but you do it, and I see you doing it. I hope you see me too. Thanks. Wow. Thank you. You guys are totally going to make me weep up here. Okay, I told you there were other parts to the speech, but I have to tell you that was like years of therapy. Right there. Done. Thank you. I so appreciate you listening to that, and I so appreciate you hearing it. So I want to tell you a tiny bit of what has happened since I had delivered that speech to that very loud room, and the first was that I was so upset by people not hearing it that I went and published it online. Maybe some of you read it. It spread like wildfire, which I know is a really sketchy metaphor to use in this area, but I mean it in a good way. And the second is that I found out a lot of people agreed because they contacted me and there were numerous talks. And I would say I am asked to speak about this 3 or 4 times a week at this point. A lot of people want to talk about this. And then the third is that everyone asks me what to do about it. That is a thing that happens, which is actually, by the way, completely nuts. They ask me how to fix the problem of diversity as though by bringing it up, I should have the expertise to fix it. But I want to say that that's a little like asking a hungry person how we should fix famine, right? I don't know. I don't have the answers. All I know, if anything, is what not to do. And I know you guys have seen the various depressing statistics over the last few years, everything from how many books by women and minorities are being published, sad, to reviewed, sadder, to diversity within the people that work in the publishing industry, that just came out a couple weeks ago, saddest. And I'm also familiar with the disorientation that comes with reading statistics that at first glance don't seem to affect you. Like when I read that between November 2008 and April 2009, roughly 1 out of every 5 books sold in the United States was written by Stephanie Meyer. Did I say that didn't affect me? Sorry, I meant that made me want to lie down and die. But back to my original point. You can hear statistics and do nothing more with them than be immobilized. And this is what I fear most, coming into a room like this and speaking, that somehow I will relieve anyone of the obligation to do anything further. You know, like, listen to the brown lady, fulfilled moral obligation, gonna go find an enchilada. Because the only thing that I know will really change things, is you caring. And I know how obscure that sentiment can be, so I'm going to nail down this part of it a little with a discussion that some of my friends have been having. Did anyone happen to see Marlon James's video in The Guardian about being anti-racist, non-racist versus anti-racist? Anyone happen to see? It was amazing, yeah? Okay, so I'm going to break that down a little because I can tell the vast majority of you didn't, and it's a brilliant video, and it'll take 2 minutes of your time should you ever want to watch it. But it was kind of a thing of wonder, and it was brewing for weeks because it started with a Facebook post from the novelist Caitlin Greenridge, who's a friend of mine, who pointed out, in light of everything that has been happening across our country, that there are very few of us that would think of ourselves as racist. In fact, I'm guessing that no one in this room would want to be associated with that word at all. Just the Neanderthal stink of it is enough to make you push it away. So we see the news of the day, whether it's about black boys being killed by police or Muslims becoming targets for people's untethered fear or minorities not finding a way into publishing. And we say, not me. That is not me. I would never do that. I really hope that changes, because if that changes, I am in support of that. That's non-racism. The understanding that you would never openly harm anyone, and then the correlating assumption that therefore you are not harming anyone. Or to quote Marlon, what you end up with is an entire moral stance, an entire code for living your life and dealing with all the injustice in the world by not doing a damn thing. That's what's great about non. You can put it off by simply rolling over in your bed and going back to sleep. So what is anti-racism, you ask? Anti-racism is action. It's standing up and saying no more. It is being visible and demanding and fighting for change, whether that is marching or speaking or seeking out narratives that speak more to just the white American experience. It is treating your minority writers with the same level of respect that you give your non-minority writers, whether that is pay or opportunity for promotion or allowing them book covers that represent the story inside and not the ethnicity of the author. That is the stuff that matters. It really does. And I will go one step further and say, if you don't do it, when you stick to the easy non-route of non-confrontation, when you wait for this change to happen, even with the widest of open arms, you do us tremendous harm. We often frame the need to be represented in terms of children, right? What it means for a kid to see a story about someone that looks like them, whose world looks like theirs, who faces the same challenges they do, but really, This is not a need that disappears with age. Minorities in this country, adults and children alike, need to see ourselves in the center of the story. It is the only way for us to survive and thrive. That so many of us have gone without it for so long is unfathomable. But you can change that. You can change that if you really want to. So I'm going to ask everyone, for everyone who is not in this room with us today, all those people out there who are out making this country smarter and stronger and more interesting every day, who deserve to see themselves represented by this country's literature, I'm going to ask you to please, please want to. Thank you. Thank you.